It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We're going to re-air some of our favorite recent interviews now as our team takes this Friday off. Having the Supreme Court lift its ban on gay marriage was a main objective of the LGBT movement for decades. Last year, of course, that goal was achieved, and same-sex marriage was made legal in the United States. Though a victory, my next guest says that because the LGBT movement has been so focused on and driven by the pursuit of marriage equality, there has been little time for discussing what the movement's priorities should be now that the goal of marriage equality has been achieved. Carlos Ball, law professor at the Rutgers Newark campus, brings together 12 original essays by leading scholars of law, politics, and society in a new book to address the most important questions facing the LGBT movement now. Where should they go next? The book is called After Marriage Equality, The Future of LGBT Rights. Carlos Ball, welcome back to WNYC.
A pleasure to be here, Brian.
And I'll say about the book that it looks at multiple areas in which the energy of the LGBT community needs to be focused. And in the first essay, Will Victory Bring Change?, that author talks about how the achievement of marriage equality actually introduces some obstacles into the LGBT movement as a whole. So what would you say are the main obstacles that it presents?
Well, one possible problem is simply this sense that with marriage equality, there's really not much work to be done anymore. Because as you said, for many decades, it was the main objective of the movement. But the reality is that there's a lot of work that remains to be done. And one of the challenges of the movement is to remain committed, to remain focused, to remain energized. For example, the vast majority of states in this country do not prohibit discrimination on the basis of either sexual orientation or gender identity. So it's possible for a same-sex couple to be married on a Sunday and to be fired on a Monday or denied housing on a Tuesday.
I see 29 states do not have laws that prohibit housing discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. 30 states do not prohibit discrimination in public accommodations, which include government spaces and private businesses like restaurants, movie theaters. 16 states do not have protections against discrimination in hiring. So in those states, a gay person can get married one day and be fired the next solely because of their sexual orientation. Those counts of the states, courtesy of the Human Rights Campaign. And I guess maybe the thing that we saw break out in North Carolina recently, which most of the publicity was about trans people being able to use bathrooms, really was so much broader than that, because what the state legislature there passed was a bill forbidding any locality in the state from passing any LGBT anti-discrimination law.
That's absolutely correct. So Charlotte, in March, Charlotte, North Carolina, became the first municipality in the state to enact an anti-LGBT discrimination law. The state legislature, controlled by Republicans, reacted by enacting the law that you just mentioned. And you're absolutely right. Most of the attention has been paid to the bathroom issue, which is a very important issue. And the federal government is taking the state of North Carolina on in an important lawsuit, as it should. But there is this other issue that hasn't received as much attention. And that is that the legislation deprives local voters of the ability to enact anti-discrimination laws if that is their choice. And that's a real problem.
Could this be a constitutional issue, too? If you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation for marriage, then something in the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment or something would also say you can't discriminate on that basis, like you can't on race, like you can't on gender, for sexual orientation, for hiring, for housing, for everything?
Absolutely. So the Supreme Court in 1996, in a case called Romer versus Evans, struck down a Colorado constitutional amendment that would have deprived gay people but no other groups of anti-discrimination protection. And I think there's a very good argument that can be made that Romer versus Evans does not allow for the type of law that was enacted in North Carolina, because it is a law that essentially targets LGBT people for differential treatment, and that does in fact violate the Equal Protection Clause.
Now, one of the essays in the book is called Two Steps Forward, One Step Back, and it discusses the possibility that attainment of marriage equality may leave progressives in general feeling less inclined to expend money and energy on LGBT issues like AIDS or transgender issues. And yet I wonder if the opposite is happening, because I think in the last year, since the Supreme Court marriage equality ruling, it seems like the focus on transgender equality has only been amplified, maybe because that's you know, maybe that's partly because there's more air in the room now for things other than marriage equality. And so issues, rather than, you know, falling victim to progressive fatigue, are being able to rise.
I think it is exciting the way in which transgender issues have become part of the progressive agenda. And I think that's one of the ways in which the whole debate about marriage equality has really changed the way in which our society is dealing with issues of sexuality and issues related to gender identity. So there is, in fact, more air in the room, and that is reason for optimism. On the other hand, with some exceptions, a lot of this work will not be the result of winning in the courts. In order to get laws enacted, hard political work is going to have to be done. Hard legislative work is going to have to be done. And there is the danger, some of the essays in my book point out, that the focus of the movement will dissipate. Marriage equality focused the mind, so to speak, of the movement. There is a danger that we will lose that. And I think that's why we need to be constantly fighting against that possibility.
Jim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Rutgers Law Professor Carlos Ball. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First, I want to say I have no opposition at all to gay marriage, but it is the worst sort of revisionist history to describe it as something that's been an effort for decades. Gay marriage was an agenda established by people like Andrew Sullivan, the gay conservative Republican from England, in the 80s and 90s to sort of mainstream gay politics and gay life, essentially to make it more conservative, more conventional, and to enable people like the Andrew Sullivans of the world, privileged, educated, mostly white, to consolidate their privileges. Remember that the original gay rights movement coming out of Stonewall was influenced by 1960s, 1970s New Left theory and was countercultural. Critical of mainstream agendas like marriage. So I support gay marriage, it's fine and dandy, but let's not pretend that it's something other than the effort of privileged people to consolidate their privileges.
Carlos Ball?
Well, I appreciate the comment, and it's certainly true, I think, that marriage equality has dominated the discussion on LGBT issues over the last 25 years. And that domination has had some positive effects and I think some negative effects. The positive effects is that, for example, I don't think we would be having these very honest discussions about the place of transgender people in our society without some of the advances made as a result of marriage equality. On the other hand, there has been the problem that it has been, for the most part, relatively well-to-do segments of the LGBT community that has been committed to marriage, and some of the other voices in the movement have not been as vocal. In terms of the history, you know, the history is a little bit more complicated. Because, in fact, some of the very first same-sex marriage lawsuits were brought in the early 1970s, just a couple of years after Stonewall. At the time, some of the sexual liberationists to which the caller is referring to very much believed in marriage, the pursuit of marriage, not because they thought they could get it at the time, but because they thought they could use the fight for marriage to really change the conversation about sexuality and gender in our society. So it's a complicated history.
And before you go, when discussing what's going to happen next, now that there's marriage equality and where that sets up the movement for obstacles and for successes, there is experience we can draw on here, because the United States is not the first country to grant same-sex couples the opportunity to marry. And the book ends with chapters written by people from three countries, Canada, Holland, and France, that preceded the U.S. down this path. So are there any particular lessons from those countries?
Well, there are some lessons to be learned from those countries. Number one, especially in France, there has been significant backlash on the part of conservatives in general and religious conservatives in particular against same-sex marriage. And so kind of like the same way that in this country the LGBT movement and its allies are fighting a rear guard action against backlash. That very much happened in France as well. I think in Canada, David Rayside, who's the political scientist who wrote the chapter in my book about Canada, notes that there has been some dissipation of energy and focus and less money coming into the movement as a result of marriage equality in Canada, and that and there is a fear that something like that may happen in the United States.
Carlos Ball, law professor at Rutgers Newark, is the editor of the new book of essays, After Marriage Equality, The Future of LGBT Rights. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. This 4th of July brought with it a different kind of rocket-related celebration. As much of the nation watched fireworks or finished off their last slices of apple pie, the scientific community erupted in joy when a few musical tones signaled that NASA's Juno spacecraft had successfully entered Jupiter's orbit, where it remains today. With me to discuss the wondrous science behind the mission and to break down what it all means is Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Hey, Miles, welcome back to WNYC.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Good. I thought for a minute that you were on Jupiter, and so we were having like a 30-second delay for the speed of sound.
Houston, we have a problem, huh?
How long does it take? Like, if a person was on that ship, how long would it take for them to hear words spoken on Earth? Any idea?
45 minutes. So if we were to try to have a conversation, there'd be a 90-minute round trip, which makes jokes very hard.
Jokes, yeah, because the timing is everything, right?
That's right.
How about the speed of light, being able to see through whatever devices NASA actually uses what's going on with Juno?
Well, what's going on with Juno right now? So far, so good. And it is moving not quite the speed of light, but was the fastest moving craft ever made by human beings as it entered the clutches of Jupiter. It slowed down a little bit because they had to slow down or else it would have whizzed right by the planet. So it's good it's in orbit.
I see that Juno's principal investigator called this mission the hardest thing NASA has ever done. What exactly made this trip so difficult? I guess harder than keeping humans alive while they travel to the moon and back.
Yeah, you know, I think that was said with tongue firmly in cheek a little bit. He was being a little bit effusive in the moment. But it isn't, you know, listen, anytime you fly for 5 years over 1.8 billion miles and arrive, a rocket burns within 1 second of its prescribed burn, and you enter the orbit of this menacing giant planet, that's hard. That's hard stuff. But, you know, when you compare that to landing human beings on the moon, I think we could have a debate on that one.
So, listeners, anything you always wanted to know about sending a spacecraft to Jupiter but had no one to ask, here you go. We have Miles O'Brien, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And this isn't the first time we've sent a spacecraft to Jupiter. Pioneer 10 flew by in the 1970s, and Galileo entered its orbit in the 1990s. So why did we need to go back?
Why go back? Because there's so much more to know. Yeah, this is about the 10th mission, depending on how you count. Except for Galileo, all the other missions have been flybys from Pioneer through Voyager, New Horizons. As they whiz by, you can't get anywhere outside of Jupiter without going by Jupiter. It's so big. They would snap some pictures along the way. Galileo in the 90s and into the early aughts spent 8 years in the orbital pull of Jupiter and analyzing some of its moons, originally discovered by Galileo in the 17th century, and brought back a treasure trove of data. But it was all, except for one probe which went in toward the end, it was all at the surface. And when we look at Jupiter, we really don't know what's going on beneath the surface. That giant red spot, which is a storm the size of Earth and has been going on for 300 years. The weather just never gets better there. What's going on beneath that? And that's what Juno may give us answers on.
I've read in a number of articles about Juno that scientists hope the observations made by the craft will give us clues to how the solar system came to be and evolved to its current state. It could do that?
Yeah, so first there was, kind of a black hole type implosion. Out came our sun, And the next thing that formed of the eight planets was Jupiter. And so what has happened over time, over the 4 billion years that brought us to have this conversation, is a lot of things changed here on Earth. But because Jupiter is so big and sort of, you know, in some respects, a partially formed star, it has kept all of its ingredients pretty much as is. It's like a deep freeze of the ingredients that brought all of us to where we are today. So if you want to look back in time and see how the planets formed, how the solar system formed, ultimately how we got to where we are, Jupiter is a great place to do it.
Let's take a call. Derek on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC.
Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Mills, do they use repeaters or relay satellites to get the signal back and forth? And additionally, do they use repeating signals to make sure the message is received intact, because the distances are so vast that the signal could degrade, and additionally, because of the vast distances, the signal could get interrupted by objects moving around in space?
Great questions. First of all, Juno has about 600 watts of power. As a matter of fact, parenthetically, it's the farthest we have sent a space probe that relies on solar power. Only 5% of the sun's energy that we get here, you get in Jupiter. So those solar arrays really have to do their job. But 600 watts to transmit all this data back to Earth requires some very big antennas. And we call it the Deep Space Network. There is an array of antennas in California, Spain, and Australia. So there's always one pointing, as the Earth rotates, pointing toward Jupiter. And they are just like a giant ear cupping your hand behind your ear, listening for the signals. They're faint, and the bandwidth is not great. So they just have to listen for a long time and take it all in. It's like an old 2400 baud modem. You just have to wait for that image to come in or for that data to come in. But there's no enhancements or repeaters. It's just that simple 600-watt spacecraft spitting out its data as fast as it can, and some really big antennas here on Earth.
And we were talking earlier about how it takes 45 minutes for an audio signal to travel from Jupiter to Earth, but I read that it's supposed to take several days for the images taken by Juno to be transmitted back to Earth. Why would they take longer if light travels faster than sound?
It's all about pixels and how you know, how big an image you want to send. You can imagine, you know, just when you send an email of a picture you've taken, if you make it smaller, it goes faster. If you send the full size, it takes a little while. So that's pretty much what it boils down to. The camera itself is taking a big wide field image, fair number of pixels, and it's just it's like sipping through a straw. It takes a little bit of time to pull it down.
Ashton in Midtown, you're on WNYC. With
Hi.
Space reporter Miles O'Brien from PBS. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering how you guys were able to outfit the Juno to withstand like radiation and stuff. If you guys don't even know, you know, a lot about Jupiter, how are you able to protect all of this equipment from stuff that, you know, you may not even know is there? Was it like guesswork? Was it, do you have a pretty good idea? How are you keeping it functional?
It's a great question. Because the trick is, you don't want to shield the instruments so much that they can't do their work. So you have to kind of thread a needle between the usefulness of the instrument and protecting it from failing under the harsh – to call it harsh is an understatement. The radiation environment there is tremendous. And they will, in order to get beneath the surface of Jupiter, have to kind of get underneath that radiation belt. And so they put – most of the instruments inside a titanium box, and that titanium will presumably, and believe me, this wasn't guesswork. This was all, there's a lot of calculations that went along with this. That box should allow enough data in, but will protect the instruments. That's the hope, but this has never been tried before. The camera itself, JunoCam, will sit outside of that titanium box. Obviously, it needs to do its job separate from being inside a box. So while it has been shielded against radiation, we don't know how long it's going to last.
JunoCam, do they really call it that?
They really call it JunoCam. And JunoCam, interestingly, the mission, the science of the mission did not require a camera. And scientists could have done this mission without images, but what a shame for them to go 1.8 billion miles and not put a camera on for us to take a look. And the interesting thing is, Brian, come fall, once it gets all calibrated and they've taken a few shots and they've tested it out, we, the general public, will be able to go to the website and get to vote on where we want to point the camera based on the previous images. What's interesting to us generally will be which direction the camera is pointed.
JunoCam sounds like something from the old David Letterman show. They could have come up with a more creative name. But Juno is completely solar powered. Do I have that right?
That is correct. And, you know, Galileo was powered by a small piece of plutonium, nuclear powered. In this case, they wanted to try to see how far they could push the solar power capability. Solar has improved here on Earth and thus in space. And so it is squeezing out just at the very edge of solar capability to run this spacecraft. But that's why they wanted to try it, because it could mean that they can push farther into space with solar power, depending on how well this goes.
Amy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Brian, and Mr. O'Brien. You said that Jupiter was almost massive enough that it could have turned into another sun, in which case that would have a profound effect on the rest of the solar system. And I've also heard it called a sentinel planet, that it's so big it pulls in most of the debris that could hit, you know, Earth or other planets. And I'm wondering, is there sort of a Goldilocks zone for a large planet in the solar system that makes it more likely that that life will evolve in the system if it's just the right size, and doesn't make it less likely that for life to develop in star systems that don't have a planet just the right size?
Great question. We believe, and, you know, we're still looking around. We've identified a lot of potential targets out there where that Goldilocks phenomenon might exist. And basically, the way we interpret Goldilocks is proximity from an object orbiting a star, their sun, in such proximity that water can be found in liquid form. And that's a key thing. Everywhere we look on this planet, wherever there is liquid water, we find life. It doesn't matter where. And so as we look for this Goldilocks zone, we look for planets that might be in that spot where water could be in liquid form. But to your point on Jupiter, you know, obviously we orbit in that Goldilocks zone here. We have lots of water and we have life. But were it not for Jupiter, there's a good chance we would not be here today, because it is kind of – it's like our bodyguard. It sucks in a lot of debris that could have impacted us along the way. Now, you know, 65 million years ago, something very big hit this planet and wiped out the dinosaurs and ultimately cleared the way for us to live our lives. And I think that there might have been many more impacts had it not been for Jupiter sucking in a lot of that debris along the way.
We have about a minute left, so give me two quick media answers here, Miles. One is, I see NASA is using some kind of online voting to decide something about which images are taken.
Yes, we all can control JunoCam. So go to the NASA Juno site and weigh in. We still have a little bit of time before we're going to have an opportunity to see these images. Juno right now is in a 53-day orbit, so it won't be until the end of August before we see a first batch of pictures. But then toward the fall, as the orbits get tighter down to a 16-day orbit, we get to weigh in on what JunoCam will capture.
Awesome. And NASA's on a roll here, right? The Pluto flyby last year produced a lot of good information. They had the Mars landing in 2012. So are we entering another golden age of space exploration? And is it all supposed to be leading to something in particular?
Well, if you ask me, I sure would love to see footprints on Mars someday, Brian. But I think NASA, missions like this prove one thing. When it comes to the space shuttle, now retired, and the International Space Station, folks only have really, frankly, limited interest because, after all, it's about 250 miles away from us. The idea of transporting people to other worlds and making them think beyond Earth and the sphere of Earth, whether it's Jupiter or Mars or beyond, really captures people's imaginations and makes them think about some profound things that don't enter into our everyday lives. And I think if NASA keeps that in mind, they'll keep the public engaged.
Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks a lot, Miles.
You're welcome, Brian. Always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. This summer marks 1 year since the suicide of Kalief Browder, who took his life at his home in the Bronx at age 22 after spending 3 years on Rikers Island without a trial, two of which were spent in solitary confinement before the charges against him were dropped. With me is Jennifer Gonerman, staff writer for The New Yorker, who has reported extensively on Browder's story since 2014 before having to write his obituary a few months later. Thanks for coming back into the studio, Jennifer. Hi.
Hi there.
And Jen has a piece on The New Yorker Radio Hour about this, and many of our listeners will remember, but do you want to do a little backgrounder first? Not everybody knows this story. Who was Kalief Browder, and how did he end up on Rikers as a teenager?
He was a young man who grew up in the Bronx, not far from the Bronx Zoo. One spring night in 2010, he was walking home late from a party. At the time, he was a sophomore in high school. A police car pulls up. There's somebody in the back seat who points him out and accuses him of a robbery that took place supposedly a week or two earlier. Of a backpack. And Kalief thought he was just going to the precinct to straighten things out. He said that he was told, oh, don't worry about it, we're just going to have some misunderstanding, we're going to work it out, you'll probably be home soon. And that actually led to a sort of three-year odyssey through the criminal justice system, 3 years on Rikers Island. And he was in this terrible catch-22 situation where, in order to prove his innocence, he had to stay in jail. In other words, he kept refusing to plead guilty. And it was his insistence on his innocence, his refusal of the prosecutor's plea offers, is what kept him in jail for so long.
This summer, in remembrance of his death, WNYC's New Yorker Radio Hour aired a piece by Jennifer Gonerman composed of interviews you did with Kalief while he was still alive. We're going to play a clip now of about a minute and a half about the conditions he endured as a teenager during his time at Rikers. Kalief speaks first.
They have a vent and it blows heat for some reason. I don't know why.
In the
summer. You would think that it would blow out cold air, but it's heat. If you put your hand next to it, it's heat.
The vents did serve another purpose, though. All day long, inmates had conversations through them.
I'll fake befriend somebody.
What do you call it, fake befriend?
Right, because I'm not really trying to become your friend, but I'm talking to you, but then they feel like they're your friend, and then they want to talk about all this other stuff. I don't want to talk about that stuff.
What do they want to talk about?
Gang stuff, or I robbed this person, or I shot this person. Mm-hmm. A bunch of dumb stuff, and I don't want to hear that. And then there's times when they talk to themselves and yell at themselves and bang their heads on the wall all day, and they're very loud. You know it's real because they'll be in the vent with you for about a month or two, and they do it all day, every day. So you know it's not a game.
What if it's 11 o'clock at night? That could be going on 11 o'clock at night?
No, 11. It'd be 4 a.m. in the morning. And the dude would be kicking, yelling to the top of his lungs. Then you try to talk to them, but they don't understand what you're trying to say because they're mentally disturbed, so they get mad, and then they start doing it more.
Wow. You want to just reflect on that exchange?
Sure. That's Kalief talking about his time in what's officially known as a Central Punitive Segregation Unit, which everyone calls the BING, the main solitary confinement unit on Rikers Island. And he's talking about You know, obviously he's in a cell alone all day, 23 or 24 hours a day, but he can hear voices coming out of the vent and sometimes has conversations or with other inmates or might overhear them talking to themselves. And so the high level of mental illness that's surrounding him every day is what he's describing so well.
Knowing now with hindsight that he committed suicide, in your reporting, you've written that when you met Browder, quote, he was out of jail and not eager to revisit his time there. Did you ever fear that asking him to rehash that tough time could be traumatic for him?
Yeah, of course I was thinking about that. I mean, I did interview him in the course of many months. And on the one hand, of course, he was reluctant to revisit it. But on the other, there was another part of him that very much wanted to get his story out there to make sure that what he had gone through wasn't in vain. And so in terms of the darkest parts of his story, the suicide attempts that he made, a few of them on Rikers Island, I didn't ask him too many questions about that because for the same reason you just mentioned. However, just last week, I got depositions that he gave. He had a lawsuit going on against New York City, and he had given depositions sitting in a room with a city lawyer answering questions for hours at a time. This was late 2014 and 2015. And one of the topics that he was asked about repeatedly were these suicide attempts. And when I was reading those depositions last week, I almost fell off my chair reading some of the details that he described of what he had endured.
Let's hear another clip from the episode then. This is about Browder's experience with court delays. And this is about a minute. The delays were such an integral part of this. Waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to actually go to trial, and 3 years total in Rikers as a result. Khalif Browder.
Every time with the court, it was always that side of me that telling me, like, you're going to go home. But then I try not to hype myself up because it hurts when you think you're going home and then you don't go home. That's all I used to cut in my mind. I can't wait to go to trial so I could prove I didn't do it. That's all I used to tell myself. I'm going to go to trial, I'm going to go to trial, I'm going to go to trial. And no trial, no trial. And I used to tell myself, why aren't they ready for trial? I don't understand.
Finally, after Khalif had made 30 trips back and forth to court, a judge told him that he could go home today. All he had to do, she said, was to plead guilty.
The first thing that came to my head is for them to offer me something like that, they have to know they're wrong. So if they know they're wrong, there's no point in taking it. And I told her I didn't do it. I'm not saying I did something I didn't do. She's like, I'll let you go home today. You won't have no probation. She said a bunch of things that sounded good. And it really was tempting, too. It was a lot mentally because half of you wants to get out of there. And the other half don't want to leave just over the strength of a principal. You know, all of that put together just made my head go crazy.
Jennifer Gonerman with Khalif Browder. You can hear more of that interview on the New Yorker Radio Hour this weekend. But why was Browder's case delayed for so long? Is a three-year delay with no trial very unusual in the Bronx?
In some ways he was a bit of an outlier, but in other ways he was representative. I mean, the Bronx has become notorious for its extraordinarily long court delays. And it was his refusal, as I said earlier, to plead guilty, just as he describes, that kept him locked up for so long.
As you know, when the mayor was here, I asked him a question based on the anniversary and your reporting. And he said he believes that the reforms that the city and the court system are making are a real response to Khalif Browder and others in similar situations, and that he can say Khalif Browder did not die in vain. Do you agree with that?
It was just a straight-up American tragedy that never should have happened. Now, I'm glad that the mayor, has paid attention to his story and spoken publicly about trying to eliminate some of the court delays or fix Rikers Island. But, these problems, are so deep and are decades in the making. And, he mentioned a report on Rikers Island that had come out within the last week, and he was talking about, the reforms and how things are getting better. And things may be getting better, but, that report was not all positive. Here I'm looking at page 68 of the report. It's only a sentence, but they talk about the head strikes and the use of force against inmates, and they're still appallingly high. So there's nothing to celebrate here. And, it's just sort of the continued efforts to try to fix the broken court system and the broken jail system that will be the only sort of way that Khalif's death will, really mean anything.
And here's more of what Khalif told you, and this relevant to what you were just reading from that report, this is about abuse he experienced at the hands of guards in Rikers.
Khalif endured violence on Rikers Island at the hands of correction officers and other inmates. But when I asked him what was the worst part of being on Rikers, he didn't say the violence. It was the hunger. Sometimes, if you made a guard mad, when he came around with the meal trays, he'd skip your cell.
You're just stuck in a cell and you're getting starved and you're hungry. And then at nighttime, you can't even go to sleep because your ribs are touching. Literally, how can you not get angry at that? Just being in a situation where you can't do nothing and you know, you're helpless, that's very stressful, like, and you're just powerless.
And you're right that abusive behaviors of Rikers guards extended beyond withholding food from Browder to encouraging him to kill himself. And this is what you wrote about in The New Yorker, detailing how he learned to commit suicide while in jail. How did he learn to commit suicide at Rikers?
This is pulled from the depositions in the city court lawsuit, the lawsuit he filed against the city. He describes in those, for the first, you know, he hadn't thought about suicide before, thought it at all, and being there and seeing another young man on his cell block, being taken out of his cell after he attempted to hang himself. He did not die, but Khalif sees him come out with a sheet tied around his neck. I mean, it was like an education in suicide of sorts. And when I was reading these depositions, I almost, you know, I didn't think I was going to learn anything new, but then I get to details like that and I almost fell off my chair. I mean, at one point he describes being in a solitary cell where there was a vent above his sink, and he tries to loop a sheet through the vent's tiny holes. And these are his words. He says, "I stuffed it inside the hole with a pen. Then I kept twisting it until it curved through the other hole, and then I pulled it out." He said the whole process took 20 or 25 minutes, and that while it was going on, correction officers kept peering into his cell to check on his progress. And then in this deposition, the city's lawyer asks him, "What happened after you tied the sheet around your neck?" And he said, "The correction officers were telling me, 'Go ahead and jump. You got it ready, right? Go ahead and jump.' They said, 'If you don't jump, we're going to go in there anyway,' meaning come into your cell, so you might as well go ahead and jump."
And so literally encouraging him to commit suicide.
Well, I don't know if they're encouraging him to make an attempt. They're going to run in. It's not that they're encouraging him to die, you know, but there's a sort of a dance going on. You know, in solitary, there's deep skepticism about inmates who self-harm or attempt suicide, where a lot of officers just think, well, that person's just trying to scam the system. It's a manipulative gesture, that's their phrase, for this person to try to get themselves out of solitary. So, but this is the story he recounts to the city lawyer, where the officers are standing outside his door watching him, you know, minute after minute, threading his sheet through a vent and saying, "Go ahead and jump." And then the lawyer says to him, "Why didn't you jump?" And he says, "Because I was scared at that point." "What were you scared of dying?" He gave this deposition to the city in late May of last year, 2015, and 2 weeks later he did end his life at his home in the Bronx.
Why do you think he did kill himself if his legal ordeal had actually ended?
You know, that's a question that nobody can ever answer. I mean, he had serious mental health problems after he left jail, which I've recounted in The New Yorker. He had a serious suicide attempt, you know, several in jail, at least one afterwards. You know, but at the same time, his life was actually, you know, he had somehow, despite everything he'd been up against, gotten his life on the right track. After he got out of jail in 2013, he went and got his GED. He had missed 2 years of schooling while he was locked up, but he managed to pass his GED on the first try, which was an extraordinary accomplishment. He enrolled in Bronx Community College in fall of 2014, was there beginning of 2015. So he was moving, you know, in the right direction. But, you know, when you met him, when you sat down and talked to him, you could see that he was in incredible pain, you know, that the suffering ran very, very deep.
And relating this back to solitary confinement, you related in the piece you were just talking about how he had attempted suicide a number of times while in solitary. Do you think, and learned how to commit suicide was watching at least one other guy who was also in solitary. Do you think solitary confinement specifically played a role in the decline of his mental health?
I think without a doubt,
And
I mean, that's where his suicide attempts happened.
has at least this now been alleviated to some degree as a risk for future people, because the mayor mentioned on the show that one of the reforms that they have been able to make is ending solitary confinement for inmates who are 16 and 17 years old, which Kalief Browder was.
I mean, that's terrific news, but it's a very small portion of the entire jail population. So there's much more work to be done. I mean, the mayor talked about eliminating it for slightly older inmates, 19, 20, and they've been talking about that for a long time. The deadline keeps getting pushed back. So, you know, I'm glad to see that that's going on, but it's just the very beginning of a long process of reforms, hopefully.
Since Browder's death, there's been growing support for a significant reduction in the use of solitary confinement nationally, not just in New York. I'm sure you saw President Obama mention Kalief's name in his Washington Post op-ed that accompanied his executive order banning the solitary confinement of juveniles in federal prison. So, I'm reluctant to talk about silver linings because it's such a tragedy. But there is a legacy of reform that's now gone all the way up to the President of the United States.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the question is really whether the momentum continues. You know, Kalief got a lot of attention in after his death and in the past year. But, you know, I feel if the media takes its focus off of these issues for 5 minutes, they sort of fall off the radar of politicians and don't get the attention they need. And I think with a lot of these issues, there's just been a tremendous sort of lack of urgency among policymakers in making these reforms.
Let me take a phone call.
John, sure.
Susan on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Jennifer Gonerman from The New Yorker, who did the Kalief Browder reporting.
One thing she pointed out was how these kids weren't fed properly. Now, like from the ages of 15 to 20, if anybody has boys in their family, they know how much boys need to eat. And I think it has to do, like their brain can't form properly and the rest of their body. And I'm wondering, has this been addressed?
You know, one of the things Kalief used to talk about, when he was in solitary, they were getting their meals through a slot in the door, a food tray, three times a day. He said the food was never enough for a teenage boy. It wasn't just him. Other inmates said this also. And on top of that, what you heard him describing when he's being interviewed was that there would be sometimes when the guards wouldn't even slip a tray through his door. It was a way for a guard to sort of punish an inmate or get a little, you know, get back at them for maybe some, you know, some dispute they'd had. And he said that was this, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, those are the critical years. And the idea that you would be deprived of food, I mean, it makes you think about, you know, some of the worst prisons in the world.
Thank you for your call, Susan. Jennifer, it looks like we have Akeem Browder, mm-hmm. Kalief's brother, on the line. Do you know Akeem?
Yeah, I've spoken with him.
In Texas, about to fly back to New York, he tells us, Akeem, you're on WNYC. Thank you very much for calling in.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm definitely wanting to make sure that it's known that, you know, just with the issue that you guys alone are speaking on, Kalief was 130 pounds. He's about 5'4". For the guards that decided to take their disputes out with Kalief on a physical level, when they're grown men, they've already matured, they've already adapted to life as it is, and to take out their aggression, dispute, whatever they had with Kalief when he's a minor at the time, any teenager with a attitude or that has a gripe with their situation will have a little mouth just because of their situation. What do you expect them to have? He was an innocent young teen on Rikers, and for him to be abused and in a physical way at the very least is absurd. For a man to actually beat on a child, and then if I were to do that in on the streets with any one of our kids or our relatives, I'd go to jail for abuse, nonetheless aggressive, some kind of aggressive assault. And this guy Von Grinch, if I'm pronouncing his name right, is the officer that we see on video, in which we also have other videos that were too graphic because, I mean, Kalief attempted suicide on more than one occasion, but this officer took his aggression out on Kalief and then forged the instrument and said that he tried to escape so that he can justify why he had to use what he said, physical restraint.
You know, Akeem's talking about the video that we posted on the New Yorker website last year. You could see it today on the New Yorker site where Khalif is in solitary. The guard comes to outside his door to escort him to the shower. Before they get there, the two seem to exchange words. There's no audio, so you can't tell exactly what's said. And then you see the officer appear to throw Khalif in handcuffs to the ground. And, anybody can look at this video and make their own decisions about who is to blame. But to my eye, it looked like, an unprovoked assault and a very, very disturbing event.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
In any case, I'd just like to add in before I don't want to control the conversation, but in any case, I don't think there's any reason why an adult, and I mean, we see disrespectful kids on kids all the time, we want to call disrespectful, but in Khalif's situation, he's told me on numerous occasions what goes on, and even in that situation, since when we got the video, we had to subpoena for that specific date. So Khalif was very aware of what was going on. Even on the dates, he kept it in his mind and remembered to tell us on visiting days. And so when we had to get those videos, the Department of Correction plays games where you need that specific date to say this incident, this date, at around this time, or else they'll say that we combed the videos and you can't just get 3 years worth of videos of Khalif because there's so much corruption going on that, they want specific dates. So they play games and they have all the control in the world to do whatever they want to our teenagers, our youth, and it's just incredible how we can give that much authority to one organization when they've been known to have an abusive track record.
Akeem, I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you very much for calling in and raising your voice here.
Thank you for having me.
Has anybody been held accountable?
Not that I know of. It's interesting what Akeem says. The very first time I met Khalif, he said, "You have to get the video of this day." I don't remember exactly. I think it was September 23rd, 2012. I might have the day off by one or two. But he said that Khalif had the date right, and he had remembered this. He said, "You have to get that video." And I'm thinking, how am I possibly going to get a video of this incident that he's describing? And the incident was so galling to him, not because it was the most abusive thing that happened to him, but because it had happened in full view of the cameras. It was so brazen. It was like the officer thought he could just throw him to the ground and totally get away with it, because, of course, he did. And to my understanding, I believe the officer is still employed. And when I called several months back to find out if there had been any repercussions, they said he was just getting some sort of additional training.
We'll mention that Jennifer Gonderman's Khalif Browder reporting was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and won her staff reporter position at The New Yorker. And Jennifer brought some music to go out on today. Do you want to set this up? This is a rap tribute to Khalif Browder.
Quite a few people, painted graffiti murals or wrote poems or, made songs, tributes to Khalif. And this is just one of them by a young man in New York City.
He was innocent then, ain't do no wrong, just a citizen in the New York Bronx. Life was PlayStation, sports, Uno cards, stargaze in the dark space, Pluto Mars. They was selling Scarface, Bruno Mars. You was at mom's place, a mom who knows God, like a blue nose dog, that's beauty in the beast. The reason you chose school over the streets. Young Khalif knew knowledge was power, last name Browder, no college at Howard, still wanted to be prouder. He was just 16, all he
Tribute to Khalif Browder by Messiah Ram Kassoun. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, time for the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's the best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer, on WNYC, and Tavis Smiley is back with us now, the host of Tavis Smiley on PBS and the Tavis Smiley Show on PRI, heard Saturdays on WNYC AM 820, is out with a new book that he's also making into a movie, Before You Judge Me, The Triumph and Tragedy of Michael Jackson's Last Days. This is Tavis's 19th book. He's been on the show in the last few years for his recent ones on Maya Angelou, Martin Luther King, and his covenant with Black America. We'll talk with Tavis about the King of Pop, Martin Luther King, King James, the King of The Apprentice, any king.
And the King of Public Radio, Brian Lehrer.
Maybe a Prince, maybe a Bowie. Welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. Good to see you. You been okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Good to see you. Before we get into presidential politics and your Michael Jackson book, when Muhammad Ali died, I read these amazing stories about you and Ali that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. One about being a young aide to the mayor of Los Angeles and winding up as a witness to a Muhammad Ali Nelson Mandela moment. The other actually much more profound about Ali as a factor in your relationship with your father. Would you tell our listeners about Muhammad Ali and your family life?
The short version is that when I was a 12-year-old kid, this is always painful to talk about, but I will do it since you ask. I was a 12-year-old kid. I was accused, wrongfully accused, of doing something in my church that I did not do. The minister of my church in Kokomo, Indiana, stood up in front of the entire congregation and accused me of having done something. I didn't know what he was talking about. I was never called into his office. I was not counseled. There was no conversation at all. He stands up in front of the whole church and just demeans me, quite frankly, my character in front of the entire congregation. My father, who was a deacon and a trustee, very much involved in the church, was embarrassed. Both of my parents were embarrassed and humiliated and insulted. My father got home that night from church and did something he had never done before and never did after that, but in a momentary lapse of judgment, beat me so severely that it put me in the hospital for weeks in traction. And I could not figure out why this had happened to me. And another deacon at my church came to visit me in the hospital and brought me a gift. It was old milk crates, mm-hmm, full of records, LPs. Turns out that Berry Gordy of Motown fame had the good sense to send an engineer to follow Dr. King. Many of us think King only gave one speech in his whole life, and we think the speech only had one line in it, that I want my children to grow up in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. No, he spoke every day, was always giving speeches, and Berry Gordy recorded many of them. And so this deacon was collecting these LPs that Berry Gordy started putting out of King's speeches. And for whatever reason, Brown, I don't know why to this day, but he came to the hospital and gave me this milk carton full of King LPs. And when I finally got out of the hospital and started listening to those records,
I didn't realize the Muhammad Ali story ran through Martin Luther King.
Yeah, it goes through King. I started listening to King, and King fundamentally changes my life. I get placed in a foster home for a while. I ended up going back to my home, and the only thing that my father and I connected on, I didn't like my father. I hated him then. The only thing we connected on when I went back was Ali fights. So I fell in love with Ali. My father and I still had no relationship. I'm well into my adulthood, and my father and I still don't have a relationship. And I ended up being on the advisory board of the King's of the Ali Center in Louisville. Who knew that I'd grow up to be a friend of Ali's? And he put me on his advisory board. Long story short, I have an event one night that I'm hosting in honor of Muhammad Ali, and I called my dad and surprised him, told him to get a tuxedo. I sent him the money for the tuxedo. I gave him a ticket. He flew down to Atlanta where this event was. He didn't know where he was going, but I sat my dad at the head table right next to Muhammad Ali, and it was Ali who helped repair my relationship with my father.
That's an amazing story. How many times was Ali on your show?
Ooh, two or three times maybe. Yeah.
And he withdrew from public life as his Parkinson's disease progressed. What did he prefer to talk about when he came on in his later years?
He always loved and reveled in the humanity of other people and thought that his kindness to other people was the way he would get himself into heaven. And so he always wanted to talk about kindness and being joyful and doing for others. But he also took particular interest in messing with me, born of my Christology and his Muslim faith. He always wanted to point out to me all the contradictions in the Bible, so that every time I saw Muhammad Ali, he would have another contradiction he'd found in the Bible that he wanted me to read. And say, okay, Tavis, how do you explain this?
Do you remember one by any chance?
Off the top of my head, I don't. But it was actually stunning to me that Ali had done his research and would find, okay, In one book of the Bible, in one chapter verse, it says this. Over here, it says this. How do you square these things? His question to me was, how can you believe in something that is so inconsistent in what it's preaching? And he did it with good humor, but he always wanted to put that in my face.
Heavyweight theology champion of the world. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey. Public radio. All right, Michael Jackson. Why a book on him now, and why focus on his last days?
Because the last days to me are the most interesting, kind of like the King book. As you know, the King book was about the last year of King's life when he gave the Vietnam speech and the whole country turned against him, a story that we don't know about Martin King. I was fascinated by Michael Jackson. This might seem to some people outside of Tavis's wheelhouse, a book about Michael Jackson. Well, I grew up in Indiana, as I said earlier. Michael Jackson, of course, from Indiana. I've been a Michael Jackson fan my whole life. When Michael announced he was coming back one more time, this is it, I reached out to his mother to make sure she could help me get some tickets. I got my tickets. I got my plane ticket. I got my hotel reservation. I was on my way to London for that first show in the O2 Arena when the nerd word comes that Michael has passed. And I was just devastated like so many of us were. And I wanted to know, Brian, very quickly, what happened between the time you said this is it, I'm coming back one more time, to 16 weeks later and you're dead? So we reconstructed his entire life for those 16 days, day by day, almost by the hour. And what we give you is a portrait of what those last 16 weeks were like. I will say this. I started the book, with this question. Why gone so soon? Why are you gone so soon, Michael? When I got into the research, Brian, my question did a 180 on me. And the question became, how did you survive this long once I saw all that was going on in his life in those last 16 weeks?
Pertaining to fame, largely, because in this book you profile him as at once a genius when it came to publicity and self-promotion in addition to music, but that he was also left fragile and off balance for so much of his life by how famous he was.
Mm-hmm. Be careful what you ask for. He wanted this. He worked for this. He prayed for this. The media certainly used Michael, but Michael also used the media. And so, again, you have to be careful what you ask for sometimes. Barry Gordy, again, of Motown fame here, his name comes up once again, said to me in conversation prior to writing this book that Michael had become rudderless. And I remember so vividly Barry's use of that word, rudderless, and what happens to people, famous or not so famous, when we live lives where we become rudderless and nothing is there to anchor us. And so I wanted to write this book in part because sometimes I think we get so caught up with people's, how can I put this? We get so caught up with their iconography that we lose sight of their humanity. And I wanted to make the point that Michael clearly had so many wounds that were self-inflicted. But as I said in one of my prior books, that some of us, S-O-M-E, is not the sum of us, the S-U-M. And none of us wants to be judged by the S-O-M-E. We want to be judged by the S-U-M. And when you look at the sum total of who Michael Jackson was, he's still worthy of being celebrated.
And so is it a morality play for the rest of us on some level, even as people may read it for the celebrity factor? Mm-hmm. There's something here that even if we're not, and who is at the level of somebody like Michael Jackson and the implications of being Michael Jackson for your life, morality lesson for the rest of us?
Absolutely. And we just covered a couple of them. One, you have to be anchored to something. We sang a song in that little church where I was accused falsely. We sang a song that I remember very well, not to proselytize, but the song said, "There's a storm out on the ocean and it's moving this away. If your soul ain't anchored in Jesus, you will surely drift away." Now, you don't have to believe in Jesus, but the point is that you got to be anchored to something in life. And when you become unmoored and you become rudderless, your life just gets away from you. And I think the other thing is that when you get to a place where nobody can tell you anything, your counsel is the only counsel that you keep. It's your way or the highway. When you become, how about I put this, Donald Trump-ish, then you're headed towards self-destruction.
It's funny that you put it that way because I was thinking that those last days, as you portray them, of Michael Jackson's, are pretty chaotic with Michael turning to and away from family members and hiring and firing managers, I was going to say, faster than Donald Trump because I couldn't resist. But neither could you.
Yeah, I couldn't.
But the picture seems like someone not sure about who he can trust among his supposedly closest people and talk about unmoored. That's so sad.
It is sad when you don't know who to trust, who to believe. I had someone say to me in again working on this text, and I talked to Quincy Jones about this, of course, but there are people who said to me that when Michael stopped listening to Quincy, that story isn't really known yet, and Quincy hasn't been public so much. Everybody knows that Quincy Jones has sued the Michael Jackson estate for money that he believes is owed him, but there was a point that they had a break. And for all that Quincy had done for Michael and all that he had been to Michael, when Michael pushed Quincy Jones aside, many of us knew then that Michael was in some trouble.
Something about the music that I didn't know. You wrote about how he liked to compose and make music in the studio more than perform on stage for much of his life, even though he was so dynamic in concert. And you called it the freedom to devote himself to making music that he wanted. Was mm-hmm. that always the case for him?
I think it was always the case for him because at his heart, Michael was an artist. There's a story in the book that you might recall where Michael says to someone, and he's very serious about this, that he was afraid to sleep too long. We all know he died, of course, from that medication, trying to induce sleep. But he said one time very seriously that I'm afraid if I sleep too long, God would give all the good ideas to Prince. And so he wanted to stay awake and to keep writing and to stay in the studio because that's where he had a chance to really perfect his craft.
Did they have a relationship?
They didn't have a relationship as such. There is a funny story that's been told a few places. Prince told it publicly once, as I recall. But he and Michael had a very brief meeting about the song Bad. And they were going to do the song together. Now, you recall when the video came out, Wesley Snipes played the other character, the mm-hmm. bad character that Michael was up against mm-hmm. in the music video. But the song was written, and Quincy thought it would be a great idea for Michael and Prince to finally, these two icons, to come together. Because back in the day, you were either with Michael or you were with Prince. You know, remember those debates? Mm. And so they were going to come together on this Bad song, and Prince wanted to know only one thing. He said, whose line is this, when he saw the words, the lyrics? And Quincy said, which line? He said, this line right here. And the line was, yo, butt. Is mine. Remember that song? Your butt is mine. Quincy said, that's Michael's line. And Prince said, this meeting is over. And he walked out. Michael will never say to me that your butt is mine. Prince is like, my butt is mine. It's not yours. So they never came together.
Did not know that story.
Yeah.
And you're turning this into a movie? Is that plan already made?
Yes. I've been so fortunate to have been befriended by J.J. Abrams many years ago. And so J.J. and I have never worked together until we announced we were going to do The Death of a King book as a movie, and so that is underway. We were in meetings last week about that, and then J.J. Signed on to do this one as well. So J.J. and I are turning the King book and the Michael book both into movie projects.
Tavis Smiley's new book is called Before You Judge Me, The Triumph and Tragedy of Michael Jackson's Last Days. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Love you.
Gonna make it right. As I turn up the collar, worn my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street, but not enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see them need? A summer's disregard, a broken bottle top, and one man's soul.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls.
One, two, three, four. Get up, get on up. Get up, get on up. Stay on the scene. Get on up like a sex machine. Get on up.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest is a native New Yorker who grew up in Brooklyn and Queens, though perhaps best known as a memoirist for his book The Color of Water. He has had a long journalistic career, and his novel writing has won him a National Book Award. He's also a saxophonist and has composed songs for Grover Washington Jr. and Anita Baker. Please welcome distinguished writer in residence at NYU School of Journalism and author of the new book, Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for the Real James Brown, James McBride. It's all about the Jameses. Welcome back to WNYC.
Very nice, except that James Brown could dance, and I dance like a white guy with one finger in the air.
That's definitely dance like a white guy with one finger. You write that it's impossible to figure out James Brown, because to figure him out, we'd have to figure ourselves out, and that's like giving an aspirin to a two-headed baby. An aspirin to a two-headed baby? What does that even mean?
Well, I mean, it was just... That was just in the air when I was writing. I mean, that means if that baby has a headache, you give an aspirin to one head, the other head still has a headache.
And what about James Brown were you trying to figure out?
like who he was really, you know? Was he the kind of guy you wanted to sit down and have a beer with, or was he the kind of guy who was like as crazy as he said he was? He was always, you know, I felt he was deeply misunderstood by, you know, by America. And of course here in New York, I mean, in New York City, he was a, he was an absolute star in the black community. He was a spokesman. He was considered, he was like the uncle from down south who comes to your house, takes out his teeth and gets drunk and embarrasses you in front of your friends. But then he says, stay in school, and you love him and you know he loves you. And of course he had a, you know, a tremendous effect on this town. He lived here and so forth. So
on that scale that you laid out, from want to have a beer with him to he's really as crazy as he says he is, where do you come down?
Well, the more I found out about him, the more I liked him. I'd say he wasn't crazy at all. I'd say he was a brilliant guy who had a very tragic personal side, who tried very hard to keep people, who really was an expert at keeping people from knowing who he was. He was extremely gifted in that regard.
Why wouldn't journalists have figured him out by now, or historians or music critics? He was one of the musical giants of the 20th century. And here, this long after he's gone, you say, well, you were trying to get the real James Brown because nobody got the real James Brown.
Well, James Brown was really a child of the South. And he was more of a Southerner than he was a black man. And in that regard, there were a lot of things about him that were intrinsic to his Southern nature, the way he lived, the way he did his hair, the way he was always trying to be proper, his fear of the white man, his you know, crazy, somewhat odd idiosyncrasies. People, you know, who wrote books about him, well, the music press is not necessarily known for its sophistication about black life anyway, or life in general. And also his Horatio Alger story, which was, you know, he was a poor guy, rags to riches. I mean, that's a kind of an easy thing to play out. But in fact, poverty is a very complicated experience. You know, poverty is very loud, and it's full of, you know, wrong sex and mental problems and all sorts of things that were missed in the telling of the James Brown story.
And he grew up early in Ellenton, South Carolina, Augusta, Georgia, performing on the so-called Chitlin Circuit. How is he remembered in Augusta?
Well, I mean, in an official way, I mean, he's probably remembered okay. I mean, he has a daughter there who's working to keep his memory alive, and also happens to have him buried in her front lawn, and or in her yard somewhere. And she's also one of those involved in the many lawsuits surrounding his estate. But in Barnwell, South Carolina, where he lived and where he was truly from, and where he died, where he was living when he died, and where he lived most of his life, he's remembered and admired greatly, because those are country people. And they knew James Brown's family when James Brown wasn't seen as some kid from a shack in Barnwell. He was actually raised in a part of South Carolina that was where his whole family was displaced by the creation of a nuclear bomb-making facility. And that's never been disclosed or written about before.
What, where his house used to be?
James Brown came from a large sharecropping family. And that sharecropping family was based in the town of Ellenton, South Carolina. Ellenton and five other towns in 1951 was basically destroyed because U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, NGE, and the DuPont Company created the Savannah River nuclear site, which is the place where they make nuclear bombs. It was the Cold War, and they displaced 8,000 people. They moved, and most of the people they displaced were black. I mean, when I say displaced, they just completely moved the towns away. So those who had houses, their houses were replaced, and they were, you know. But those who didn't, including the mostly black population of sharecroppers, they were just dispersed. And that was James Brown's family. That's the real story behind it.
And you grew up near Brown's old mansion in Queens. I think mansion is the right word. And you write, for years that house was a mystery to me. For years I wanted to set foot in it to know what went on inside there. Now I don't want to know anymore because I already know. Where is this house?
Yeah, it's on Murdoch Avenue in Queens, right near the big glass church off Linden Boulevard. I mean, it seemed like a mansion to me.
That's your word, right?
Yeah, it was my word, yeah. I mean, it was just a big house, you know. It had a little moat around it. It had a wild...
It had a moat?
It had a man-made moat with a little bridge that crossed it. This I saw from like when the gate swung open when I was one of the many kids who was standing out there hoping Mr. Brown would come out. But my sister Dottie actually, you know, my sister Dottie did something that no kid in New York that I knew ever did, which was she went to the front door and knocked. And she got to meet, you know, Mr. Brown. And she became a star for a long time in my house because of that.
She just went and knocked on the door and said, I live in the neighborhood and I'm a fan?
Well, yeah, well, that's what she did. And he opened the door and he spoke. Well, you know, a maid answered and then he came to the door and he told her, he said, stay in school, Daddy. Don't be no fool. And she used to, we ran with that in my house for years. She became like a maid member of the mob after that.
So after all these years, did you go back to this house for the book?
Yeah, I went and stood outside there, but I mean, there's nothing to see. He lived in that house for 10 years.
Uh-huh. Somebody lived there now?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. That house was said to be owned by all entertainers. You know, St. Albans at the time was the home of Milt Hinton and Brooke Benton, Lena Horne, Roy Campanella. A lot of the black stars moved out there. And, you know, it's kind of historic, this Addisley Park area. But, you know, all that's good. James Brown didn't like New York at all.
Really?
No, he didn't like living here.
What about it?
Well, he felt the Northerners were racist and, you know, that they didn't say what they thought about you. And he had a lot of, you know, paranoia or fear or dislike of how we handle racial relations here.
He preferred his racism more out in the open, which he found in the South?
Yeah, absolutely. And he also preferred the good old boy network. I mean, when he died, James Brown's manager and his accountant were both old, good old boy Republican white fellas, you know.
For people who are either too young or didn't get it at the time, you write that Brown and his influence are, quote, stamped into the American consciousness as deeply as that of any civil rights leader or sports hero, including Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. On the civil rights side of that, where did he leave that stamp?
Well, you know, on two occasions after Martin Luther King was shot and murdered, assassinated, James Brown was brought in to calm communities and keep the riots from happening. One up in Boston, the other in D.C., and also in the 70s in Augusta, Georgia, there was also big racial problem, and he was brought in to kind of calm people down because he was seen as someone who was trusted. Now, he did have some moments where he was taking pictures with Richard Nixon, and, you know, he had some Republican, you know, moments with some of whoever the Republican leaders were at that moment, and he was criticized for that. But in general, he was trusted and loved by the African-American community because the music that he expressed really reflected African-American life, and he was seen as a man. He was seen as someone who was a man, you know, who stood up and said, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud, and that was one of his big hits.
Reverend Al Sharpton has said, everything I am today, a lot of it is because of James Brown. Different generations, how close were they?
Listen, when you hear Reverend Sharpton talking, you're really hearing James Brown. Because Reverend Sharpton spent 15 years at James Brown's feet. He met James Brown when he was 17. And he went on the road with him at age 17. And he left New York as Al Sharpton, the boy wonder preacher from Brooklyn,
right,
and returned here as the Reverend Al Sharpton, who, you know, who raised hell with Mayor Koch and everybody else who came along after. So he, you know.
So the cadences, the inflections, things like that?
The showmanship, the whole business of walking in, killing them, and leave. I mean, that's one of the things that James Brown taught Reverend Sharpton. You know, come important, leave important. When James Brown performed, he would have his band hit. You know, they'd be banging, and the audience would just be so greased, and he knew exactly when to come out and just knock them dead. And then when he was done, he would go, he would leave the stage, get his hair done, which sometimes took 2 or 3 hours, and then he would leave. And he wouldn't hang around and glad hand and so forth. And Sharpton took a lot of that showmanship to his political life.
And you call Brown's post-mortem legal entanglements, quote, a troubling metaphor for what the race discourse has become in America now. Explain.
Well, James Brown left every penny he had, his publishing, his music, his likeness, everything, which was worth $100 to $150 million, I'm told, in a trust fund that was supposed to give money for a trust fund to educate poor children in South Carolina and Georgia. That was 10 years ago, and in 10 years, not a single kid has been educated because that money has been tied up in lawsuits between his children and his last wife and, you know, the state of South Carolina. The state of South Carolina administers James Brown's money and his likeness and his estate. That would not happen if he were Elvis Presley or John Lennon. I mean, it's shameful.
And last thing, since we're in the throes of this crazy election year, you write that the entertainment world and politics are more similar than most realize. So in what ways did you mean, and do you have James Brown's voice in your head in any way as you watch these candidates?
Well, when I see Donald Trump, I want to say, you know, get on out of here, get on up. No, I mean, there's so much show business in politics today that it's just, I didn't even know how to respond. The only thing I can say is that I think it's shameful that someone would go around and talk about Mexican people the way that Donald Trump has done, and that people would not speak out about it. It's just an embarrassing disgrace that people don't speak up. And the way that fellow talks about Mexican Americans, it's just shameful. I just don't know what else to say about it. I don't know what the politically correct thing to say is.
I don't want this really great conversation to end on the topic of Donald Trump. So say one more anything about James Brown.
Well, James Brown loved people. He loved education. And he really wanted people to get along. And that's why he left all of that money to all those children. And I hope they get it.
One of our great writers, James McBride, who has now written a book about James Brown, Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for the Real James Brown. Thank you so much.
Delighted. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned. WNYC. Did you ever wonder why April gets to be National Poetry Month? Don't we need it more in the dog days of summer than when the nice springtime weather seems like such a treat? So here's a chance to revisit our April series with some of the Pulitzer Prize winning poets who live and teach in our listening area. They each gave you a poetry assignment, and many of you came through big time with some great submissions, including one from Jack from Brooklyn, who turned out to be our then intern, now sometimes producer. Check them out at WNYC.org/poetry. And listen now as poets Vijay Seshadri, Gregory Pardlow, and Tracy K. Smith read some of your work and some of their own and share their thoughts about life and poetry and how they intersect. I'm joined by Vijay Seshadri. He was last on the show after winning the Pulitzer Prize in 2014 for his book, Three Sections. So nice to have you again. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
And we asked you for an assignment for the listeners, and you came up with a little creative stimulation that includes getting three arbitrary elements into a brief poem: a dog barking in the night, a generalization about the state of the world, and a moment of being blinded by the sun. And we'll read a few examples that some of you sent to us in the last day. Does giving beginners, though, arbitrary rules like that kind of make it easier to start writing? Is that why you do it?
Yeah, I think I do it for two reasons. One is that prompts are really useful for poets at whatever level of commitment and involvement in the art. And also I do it because the heart of poetry is seeing likeness in unlikeness, taking disparate elements and finding some sort of invisible connection.
And these are pretty disparate elements. A generalization about the state of the world. Well, on a politically oriented show, our listeners do that every minute.
Sure.
But a dog barking in the night and a moment of being blinded by the sun, all in the same short piece of poetry, kind of disparate, really interesting to make your mind go in those three directions and find a unified expression. By the way, listeners, we got about 40 submissions since we tweeted this out in the last day, and you can see them all if you like at wnyc.org/poetry. And we're going to read one right now. This is very short and manages to convey quite a bit in just a few words from a listener named Judith Kitta. Do you want to do the honors?
Sure. I am listening to the memory of his beagle barking at Shadow's deep home in the south. The sun blinds my eyes as I watch the sky. How overexposed my tears help bring him home. Now, a different boy.
So is Judith Kitta a good student?
I think, you know, she honed in on what is deeply characteristic of her. I don't know her at all, but she organized everything around a central emotion very, very quickly. She took disparate elements and made them revolve around a central feeling that she understands, but that is conveyed to us indirectly. So we feel its power without knowing its actual, you know, source in her life or in the world. And
I guess
and
the
so,
emotion,
yeah, she is a good student.
The emotion was expressed at the end. My tears help bring him home. Now a different boy.
Right. Exactly.
I understand when you give this assignment in class, you use 7 elements, not 3.
Right.
But we're using a more radio-friendly short turnaround version with just 3. Yeah. Where would you start if you were to write a poem using those elements?
I think I would always start with the barking of the dog for some reason.
As she did.
Don't know why it's...
The memory of the beagle barking at Shadow's deep home in the south was her first line.
Right, yeah. And then... The 7 elements I would twist around. With these, it seems like if you're going to make a generalization about the state of the world, it would be much harder to make it at the end of a poem than to make it at the beginning of a poem, because a generalization about the state of the world would be a culmination.
Yes.
And it's kind of hard to culminate. You know, it's kind of easier in a poem to sort of slide out of it.
I saw in an interview where you said, quote, what's at the heart of writing poetry is making metaphors, and I don't quite know if it can be taught. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah. I think this is an argument that goes all the way back to Aristotle, that there are certain things you just have to bring to the table. And Aristotle says in the Poetics that making metaphor is something that cannot be taught, and it is at the center of the ability to make a poem, which is finding likeness in unlike things. And either you can do it or you can't. But once you have students who have that fundamental ability, as all of these students, they're not students, of course, they're your listeners, do, then the process of teaching and kind of analyzing and discriminating and judging can begin and can be very fruitful.
Our listeners are students of life.
Right.
And we have one more that you picked out to read from the submissions from our listeners to the assignment. And if you're just tuning in, our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Vijay Seshadri, who gave a little assignment to you to write a short poem using the 3 elements: a dog barking in the night, a moment of being blinded by the sun, and a generalization about the state of the world. And so we have one last one. You want to set this up?
Sure. This is from Jack, who lives in Boswick, Brooklyn, which I guess is Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Kind of the old Dutch for Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this is that it's about getting the assignment rather than the assignment itself, because it starts out with Jack in the car listening to the Brian Lehrer show and hearing a prompt about a poem. So it's conceptual, it is postmodern, it's self-reflexive, it has all of these kind of complicated qualities that have to do with our aesthetic moment. And so this is the poem. There will come a Homeric moment when you will be driving in New Jersey, maybe, or thereabouts, on a skyway whose Polish folk hero proprietor pays no mind to the ghoulish poetics of the cage. And just as you teeter on the precipice of comprehension as to why so much bridge, so little water, the kind of half-contemplation that only Peabody-worthy talk radio bliss can engender, you'll be shaken in place by the déjà vu that accompanies hearing one's own thoughts read aloud by a voice not quite yours. And the voice will crackle about nocturnal dog howls and moments of Manfred Mann, and you'll smile a sheepish wolf's grin, knowing that your poem only contains these elements in reference to itself. Postmodern isn't dead, you'll squeal. But God is, God is. And you'll be wrong. But sometimes it's nice to be visited by ghosts.
Really good.
Yeah.
and it was meta upon meta, because right. Not only was it a poem about being assigned the poem, but even that line, you'll smile a sheepish wolf's grin, knowing that your poem only contains these elements in reference to itself.
Right, yeah.
So referring to him, referring to himself.
Yeah.
I hope Jack enjoyed being shaken by the déjà vu that right. accompanies hearing one's thoughts read aloud by a voice not quite his.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of I liked about that. On the Pulaski Skyway, which he called the Skyway, whose Polish folk hero proprietor, and then writes, pays no mind to the ghoulish poetics of the cage, which right. is, I guess, the experience of being in a car.
Yeah.
Which is a nice way to put that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful kind of acrobatic, self-referential poem.
I see that you teach nonfiction writing, too, at Sarah Lawrence. Is that easier to learn to do well? Is it easier to teach?
I think I wouldn't. The comparison I always make is between learning the violin and learning the piano. It's easier to move forward and progress quickly when you're playing the piano than it is with the violin, because the violin requires a certain amount of dexterity that the piano doesn't, just physical dexterity. And I would say that's the difference between poetry and prose writing. But eventually, with both the violin and the piano, things get equally hard at a certain point, you know, and that's what happens with prose. You can kind of move very quickly early on. But afterwards, you face the same complications and dilemmas. And
does poetry make you focus and distill your ideas down to their essence?
Yeah.
While nonfiction allows for, on the one hand, on the other, complexity?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the heart of poetry is capturing the metaphor in the lyrical moment and developing it as quickly as possible. And even though there might be gaps in the completion of the poem, from time to time, you always have to come back to the lyrical moment, whereas you can work in a very workmanlike way with prose and keep at it.
We thank Vijay Seshadri for starting us off, and you may know his Pulitzer Prize 2014 book, Three Sections, and if you don't, you should. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Gregory Pardlow won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for his book Digest. He joins the faculty at Rutgers this fall. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
The Pulitzer Prize cited your quote, clear voice poems that bring readers the news from 21st century America. So your assignment for the listeners is very in keeping with that. It was kind of complicated. You wrote, choose a broad theme, for example, work, race, history, sex, etc. Then from your local newspaper, collect six or seven headlines that speak to your theme in some way. Arrange the headlines so that there are no more than 10 syllables on each line of text. Then revise the poem, altering at first only one word at a time, sifting the language for a surprising message and unique turns of phrase until the poem reveals an unexpected attitude or an opinion on your theme. My goodness, you must have a very complicated brain.
That's
or you're very into game theory.
Yeah, that's actually a simplified version of a much more complicated assignment. The idea, really, I think the thing that perhaps pushes it into a more complicated realm is the meter, the idea of keeping 10 syllables on the line. The whole point of the exercise, I think, we often look at poetry or expect poetry to tell an interesting story or to give us some wisdom or profound insight, and that tends to be intimidating, and so people have this terror of the blank page. This assignment is meant to focus poets on the language itself, right? And so just getting some words on the page and having something, some material there to work with, and to think about how language is the star of the show more than the message or the content.
And while it may sound intimidating when I read it like that, it does offer very concrete steps. So you can go step one, choose a broad theme, work, race, history, sex, then choose those six or seven headlines, then arrange the headlines so there are no more than 10 syllables on each line of text, etc. So at least there's a very specific next step.
Exactly.
If you have writer's block or creative block.
That's exactly the point, yeah. And from there, the door is open, of course. You don't stop with the rules, and that's just to get some information, some words on the page, and then you can begin to rearrange them in a way however the language moves you. And I got to say, your listeners did some really fantastic job, a really great job of carrying out this exercise.
So you've graciously agreed to read
a couple
of these?
No, I'd love to. There was RCT from NYC. The title of the poem is Art Moves Us. Suffering for art in Greece, matching the national mood. Every heartache counts on the way to opening night. A sky tells a story, not for the few. Art takes new forms right before your eyes. Hamilton and history, are they even in sync? Oddity and sameness blend, a double bill. I am not the decorator, female architect speaks out. From tease to payoff, spark to deed, the virtual flame of art. Now this goes in many directions, right? And you have this sense of the pastiche and the collage of the language, but we have there's humor there. Right, so there's this. I am not the decorator. So the female architect is presumed to be the decorator, and so there.
I remember the headline actually.
You actually remember the headline
from the article that this writer must have referred to there. After putting "I am not the decorator" in quotes, then came what I remember to be the headline: "Female architects speak out."
Mm-hmm. And it's also a great way to engage with the material around us, right? So another misconception I think we have is that the poem has to hearken to some ancient or timeless, as I say, wisdom. And this keeps the poet sort of grounded in the day-to-day life.
Do you use exercises like this in writing your own poems?
I do, as a way of generating, so starting out my day, my writing day. I also like to I like to translate poems as a way of getting my mind working and little sort of games like this just to get material going. It doesn't always end up in a poem, but it does pretty frequently end up in lines that I'll set aside that are surprising to me that I would not have come up out of my own head, right? So this kind of forces me to approach the language in a way that I might not ordinarily do.
So that's one way that poets work or that you work. You'll think of a line and you don't have a context for it yet, but you'll store the line and look for a poem in which to place it?
Well, I'll store the line and I'll have a memory of it, and then at some point later on, another line will remind me of that previous line, and I'll say, where was that? And I'll tear my office apart trying to find it. And, right. You know, after a while, they start to coalesce into something. But, yeah, there's the line speaks to an itch that is already present somewhere in the back of my head, and I'm just not aware that it's there. Right? And so I find this language that draws that interest out.
New York poet Gregory Pardlow, with us, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for poetry last year for his book Digest. Can I go back to something you said before you read another example of what one of our listeners submitted? You said near the beginning that the point was to focus on the language. You're very interested in the language, as opposed to the ideas.
As opposed to the content of the language, right? So, again, you know, when you read, particularly when we read newspapers, we're looking for the information. But the aspect of the poem that we often overlook, which is the kind of the initial contact point for the poem, is the language itself. And so when I'm teaching, I try to get students to focus on that element because it's the least that the one thing that we pay the least attention to, I think, in our daily lives. So the language being where the source of the music and the source of the very material of the poem.
But does that mean you're more interested in the music of it, the rhythm of it, the words of it, than in what I think we usually consider is the deeper meaning of poetry, which is that it taps into emotion and reality about the world?
I think it does tap into emotion and reality about the world when it uses, particularly when it uses a different kind of sense-making, right? And so this poem that we just read, Art Moves Us, it's asking us to think about art in a non-linear way. And this is one of the things I think is really challenging about poems. It turns a lot of people off, in fact. And that is, it's asking us to let go of the one secure mode of thinking that we have been trained in and to submit to intuition. And that's a frightening place to be, frankly.
All right. So here's another listener poem following the rules of the game you laid out with the newspaper headlines and everything, from Emily in Brooklyn, who picked out a theme that you turn to in your book as well, which is children and parenting.
That's right, yeah.
And you want to read this?
Yes, absolutely. Emily writes, "Where is the magic in family dinner? It is an awkward charm. Foster parents share their stories of love and loss. The mothers of black victims emerge as a force for good. Cleaner air, fewer lung problems, they tell us. Boko Haram keeps using more children as suicide bombers. A fear of crying. The trouble with babies and airplanes."
Wow. You can hear the headlines.
You can hear the
headlines. Even if you don't know them.
Right, right. And you can hear the intelligence of the poet animating this language, right? So the surprise of the language from line to line. And I think a lot of the magic in a poem comes in those spaces between what you expect to hear next and what actually comes.
There was one that I recognized, and it's interesting to me how the writer changed it. The mothers of black victims emerge as a force for good, she wrote. And that was from a headline, I think, in the Times. The mothers of black victims emerge as a force for Hillary Clinton. She took the candidate's name out of it.
That's right.
And made it as a force for good.
Right, yeah. And again, the idea is to get something to start with on the page, you know, to get over this terror of the blank page. And once the language is there, you can begin to poke and prod and maneuver, and something invariably happens in that process.
How has fatherhood changed your poetry?
It's made me far less self-centered, I think, and it's liberated my sense of the poem. I mean, I think poets are generally very self-conscious and introverted in many ways because we're willing to work alone for long periods of time. And having children kind of takes my attention away from my sense of fear of looking silly or saying the wrong thing, and so it's liberating in a number of ways, actually.
The website LitHub published a conversation, as you must know, between you and fellow Pulitzer poet Tracy K. Smith, in which you said, quote, "The problem of the 21st century will be figuring out how to dismantle the mythology of race while honoring the real relationships and histories that we constructed while under the spell of that mythology," unquote. I'd love it if you could expand on that and tell us how that connects with your work as a poet.
Well, so race, I think race is something of a religion in America. We believe in it so deeply, and it structures all of our institutions, its structures, our market, our real estate, our communities, and in really pernicious ways and in really supportive ways. I mean, there's a reason that we come together in identity groups. And of course, that what I call a mythology, the mythology of race, has also produced a history and a tradition that is very useful to, certainly to me as an African American. Now, at the same time, I think we're at a point now where we realize that there is nothing essential, where it is, and of course, intelligent people, I think, have always realized this, but where it's becoming more and more part of the popular culture, the understanding that there is nothing essential about race, there is nothing biological about race. And if that is the case, then we should be able to imagine a world in which people's behaviors and actions are not determined by race and are neither limited nor unduly sort of privileged by race. And so this is the new possibility, new sense of possibilities, I think, is a challenge that we want to take on.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Gregory Pardlow. It's been great.
It.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll close out the series with Tracy K. Smith, who was last here just after her poetry collection, Life on Mars, won the Pulitzer for Poetry in 2012. Her memoir, Ordinary Light, which was a top book of 2015 on many lists, is out in paperback. She's a professor and director of the program in creative writing at Princeton. Tracy K. Smith, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
And your assignment to the listeners was to write a poem of 10 to 12 lines that consists of only one sentence and that also includes the following two elements: a reference to something that exists in the speaker's present and which you examine by way of a simile or metaphor, and a memory of something from the speaker's past considered by way of a different simile or metaphor. And you base that on your own poem, The Good Life, which I understand you've agreed to read for us. Will you do that?
Sure. The Good Life. When some people talk about money, they speak as if it were a mysterious lover who went out to buy milk and never came back. And it makes me nostalgic for the years I lived on coffee and bread, hungry all the time, walking to work on payday like a woman journeying for water from a village without a well. Then living one or two nights like everyone else, on roast chicken and red wine.
Ha. Huh. And that poem probably rings a bell for listeners who commute by subway, since it was featured in the MTA's Poetry in Motion series. So let's see. You want to break it down? What was the simile or metaphor at the beginning, reflecting your present?
Okay. It's people speaking about money as if it were a mysterious lover who went out to buy milk and never came back.
Aha. Uh-huh. And the one for the past?
Walking to work on payday like a woman journeying for water from a village without a well.
And did something tie those two together, or were you trying to, which came first for you, a structure you hoped to fill or the thought that you wanted to put in the structure?
Well, for me, I remember writing this poem, and it was actually much, much longer and actually rather convoluted. And so what the similes in the poem helped me to do was to condense a lot of explanation into what felt to me like immediate sensations based on little scenes.
Now, we received some wonderful submissions, as you know, from
some
of our listeners. And I'm going to ask you to read a couple, starting with Eileen B. from Jersey City. You have that in front of you?
I do. Beth David's cemetery bill for spring cleanup is on the kitchen counter, and outside, daffodils wilt in beds around the trees, their petals papery as old skin loosening from bones. I'm cooking matzah brei this morning, my father's recipe with eggs and chopped onions, and I wonder why it doesn't taste like Sunday morning in the Bronx, no matter how much salt I add, butter melting in the pan.
So she started with the bill from the cemetery, but the simile was about the daffodils outside her window.
Yeah, I like that simile because it brings us into the sense of, you know, what this cemetery bill really stands for, which is loss. You know, this is a poem of grief and remembering. And so allowing the daffodils to enact that kind of, you know, diminishing felt really emphatic to me.
And she's cooking Passover food, matzo brei, and it's a negative simile. It doesn't taste like right. Sunday morning in the Bronx, meaning her childhood, I guess, no matter how much salt I add, butter melting in the pan.
Yeah, I love, you know, the way that childhood gets connected to the present. And I also like the idea of describing something by way of what it is not like, which is sometimes a really emphatic way of thinking about what we lack.
So that's still following the rules. The negative example.
Yeah. I also feel like, you know, I give my students pretty specific assignments and I say, once you've fulfilled this, revision can take you wherever it needs to take you. Uh-huh. So I imagine that if any of the writers of these poems are going to revise them, it's okay if it becomes more than one sentence. It's okay if you deviate.
I see that in a conversation you had with fellow poet Gregory Pardlow, you said something great about metaphor and that what it's doing isn't about recreating the literal experience, but it's, quote, striving for willful distortion.
Right.
Meaning it's supposed to surprise you?
Well, I love that idea that metaphor can make us understand the emphatic nature of our most memorable experiences by telling us how unlike the thing that we are thinking. Maybe I should start over. Telling us how sometimes the things that are most startling are startling because they're unlike themselves. You know, love or loss are powerful not because they feel like love or loss ought to feel, but because they pull us into this other realm where feelings are strange and different. And I feel like sometimes writing with metaphors in mind helps me realize that and takes me to places that are that create a kind of transformation, telling me that ordinary experience is stranger than I tend to think it sometimes is.
By the way, what's the difference between simile and metaphor again?
I think technically they're both metaphors, but simile enacts that transition or that transformation by way of like or as, whereas metaphor just brings it on. You know, my father is a bear at the top of the stairs.
So they play different roles in trying to communicate your thoughts.
Right. They bring about a kind of transformation. One is more direct and one is kind of eases you in to these new terms.
All right. Another poem that took your assignment from a listener, Sybil in Short Hills. She sent in a lovely poem called The Things Mothers Lose. And you'll read that one for us, yes?
Yeah, I love this one. The Things Mothers Lose. My mama lips chase your brown cheeks like a galloping sprinter, arms embracing the phantom victory, eyes closed against the assault of defeat. Once there was a world before words, where you scattered giggles at my feet like daisy petals and offered those cheeks, dainty peaches on endless summer days, and I nibbled like a foolish child who thinks heaven owes her peaches. The last line really just won me over to this poem. I loved it in lots of ways from the beginning, but the last line really just enacted that wonderful sense of appetite and the way that everything seems like it belongs to us and is made for us, and then eventually you move to a state where you understand that these are such precious things that we don't always have access to. As a mother, I also I love the pang of the poem, you know, surrendering the child to autonomy.
Mm. And that end that you liked, I nibbled like a foolish child who thinks heaven owes her peaches. So she's got the nibbles and the giggles, because the earlier metaphor was scattered giggles at my feet like daisy petals.
Yeah, that's such wonderful sounds. And it's nice also, you know, I'm always trying to figure out what I sometimes call the exit strategy for a poem. You know, how am I going to get out of this? And sometimes sound, returning to a sound that has done some significant work earlier in the poem, can help foster a sense of closure. So you're right, Nibbled does that really nicely.
And I thought they brought kind of racial identity into it in the most beautiful, loving way. My mama lips chase your brown cheeks like a
Definitely.
Galloping sprinter. Shouldn't have to say brown, but it makes a lovely point.
It does.
And we get a poem about the election that followed the assignment. And this one's from Willa in Keyport, New Jersey. Will you read this one?
Sure. Once again, we vote. Every 4 years, we, the American people, get to vote for a new president, as though we are going to the store to buy a bouquet of flowers that will not fade, but will miraculously survive the cold weather, survive the below zero temperatures that will come, protected like the roses my father grew, warm inside his shack greenhouses built behind our house.
How does that speak to you?
Well, I really like when poems are willing to engage with what's going on in the world. So the subject matter seems great to me. Sometimes we try to imagine that there should be a distance between the public and the poetic, but I think that they can help examine one another really nicely. My favorite image in the poem is the shack greenhouses toward the end of the poem, something that feels homemade, that feels like it's situated in another point in time, that also brings the sense of this private domestic story.
And we only have about a half a minute left, but you must like poetry that takes from what's going on around us, because some of our listeners will remember you were NPR's first news poet in 2012. So you hung out in the newsroom all day and wrote a poem about the news. Did they overlap okay?
They did. The only thing that was difficult was just the impending deadline. But I thought that a great way of thinking about the world is to try and get inside the stories. And so imagining characters and imagining the private kind of urgency that sits within these larger stories about people in faraway places, that was really exciting. The poem brought me closer to a different landscape and a different kind of urgency.
Well, thank you, Tracy K. Smith.
Thank you.
Her book, Life on Mars, won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and she teaches at Princeton. And her memoir, Ordinary Light, is just out in paperback. I hope you enjoyed this August poetry break. Thank you to everyone who shared your poetry with us. Be sure and check out all the assignments and listener contributions at wnyc.org/poetry. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have a great weekend.